Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On November 23rd, 2012, four black teenagers pulled into a gas station in Jacksonville, Florida, to buy gum and cigarettes. A white man, Michael Dunn, and his fiance pulled in next to them in the parking lot. Michael Dunn demanded they turn down the rap music they were playing. He became very angry after they refused. After exchanging a few words, Michael Dunn pulled his gun out of his glove box and shot at their car 10 times. One of the boys, 17-year-old Jordan Davis, was killed. After the shooting, Michael Dunn and his fiance, who was in the store when the shooting happened, went to a hotel and ate pizza. They never called the police. After two trials, a jury found Michael Dunn guilty of first-degree murder. The new documentary, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets, looks back at the 2012 killing with a focus on the devastating effects of racial bias and the search for justice. 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets opens in the Bay Area on July 24th. It'll be showing at the Presidio Theater in San Francisco and at the Rialto in Berkeley. Today we are joined by the film's director, Mark Silver. Hi, Mark. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We are also joined by Jordan's father, Ron Davis. The film follows Ron and Jordan's mom, Lucy, as they deal with the aftermath of their son's murder, and they attend both of Michael Dunn's trials. And in the film, it feels like you are in the courtroom with them. And Ron Davis also joins us. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Rosie. Thank you for having me.
Well, Ron, it's so great to have you. I was so touched by this film. I honestly thought I was going to start crying when I introduced you because it's really, really intense. And, the first question I have to ask you is, what has this experience been like for you? Because not only did you agree to be in the film, but you're now going to rallies, you're testifying. As this film opens, you're going to a lot of the premieres. Is it safe to say that this has now become sort of your life's mission?
I'm an activist. Before the film was released and screening, I was going around the country with the U.S. Human Rights Network and becoming an activist. And I actually went to Geneva, Switzerland to speak before the United Nations conference. So it's kind of the same that I've been doing even before the film was released. This telling this story over and over again is pretty gut-wrenching. The upside to it is that I touch hearts and minds along the way. At every place that I speak, people come up to me and they say that they're going to tell at least 20 other people about the story, and just to have them connect with the families of the victims of violence. And that's one of my missions, is to make sure that we know that when we take someone's life, that there's families and supporters and community, people at school and at church that love this individual. So when you take a life, make sure that you really fear for your life and not just saying, putting it in your head that you fear for your life. It has to be something that you're trying to save your life when you take another life. Mm.
You know, what really struck me about this, Ron, is that it really humanized Jordan and it humanized your family. And we've been doing a lot of shows about police brutality and racism, and I just feel that that aspect of this is still really missing. In some ways, we're becoming so used to all of these shootings that like the individuals affected sometimes get lost in the reporting.
Yeah, well, first the defense attorney, quite blatantly said this is not about race, which he knew it was about race. See, the more you holler that it's not about race, the more you see it is about race. And, it's someone that did not grow up with racial changes in his society. All of his friends and all of his parents' friends are all white. They admitted that in the trial, and he admitted that he had no type of relations with anyone that was African-American. So all he knew about Jordan and his friends immediately after driving to the gas station and hearing the music that they were thugs. Mm-hmm. They were gangster rappers, and not even knowing my son could be a college graduate with a PhD, didn't matter, because he saw the color of their skin, and that's all he needed to see. And so that's why we're using this film to change some minds in society, that everybody that you see on television and in the movies is not the same as real life, that don't have a disposition, that people with a dark Ken or whatever have you, or gangster or gangster rappers. We're looking at this right now in the Dominican Republic, whereas they're taking the Haitians now that are dark-skinned, people that were not born in that country before 1929. If you were born after 1929, then they don't consider you a citizen anymore in the Dominican Republic, and they want to cleanse the Dominican Republic and take the dark-skinned people and send them over to Haiti now. It's incredible how we never, ever look at history and learn from history. It keeps popping up over and over again.
And we'll talk more about the details of what happened. But first off, what's also amazing, Ron, is that you really allow Mark into your life. You know, there's so much personal shots, and, you know, you're crying and you're having these personal conversations with your ex-wife and family. I mean, for me, what was also so intense, I have to say, Ron, is watching you in the courtroom and your reaction when Michael Dunn was testifying or his fiance was testifying. I mean, it almost gives me chills just thinking about it, because I feel like I'm in the courtroom just staring at you. So you're really allowing Mark to show you. You're very raw. Why did you allow Mark to make this film and also have such personal access to your family's life?
Mark has a gift, and his gift, one of his gifts, is to be non-intrusive. In other words, most of the time, I'm venturing to say at least 75% of the time, you don't even know that Mark is filming you. You have no idea, because what he does is takes so many frames of film just to get that one shot. So it's not like he's telling you, well, back up, Ron, or lean this way, or look this way. He just continues to film you until you do something that gets that shot. So most of the time, me and Lucy were not even aware that he was shooting. Most of the time, it's very rare that we would do something and say, well, we need to do this because Mark is filming. Most of the time, he's just shooting you in your daily, whatever you're doing. And that's why it's so truthful. When you look at that film, you see truth. You see the rawness of the film. And I think that's what touches people, is that these are not actors. They're really living their personal lives, and they're acting out their personal lives. And when we cry, it's not a fake cry. It's gut-wrenching, because that's how we felt at that time. So I think I take my hat off to Mark, that he did a wonderful job, and I'm glad that we picked him as a director. I'm very grateful for him to be our director, because, again, he was not trying to lead us down any certain path. We went our own way, and he just followed us down that path.
Mark, when did you first hear about the killing of 17-year-old Jordan Davis?
It was about 4 months after he was shot, in an article in the Rolling Stone magazine. And probably 6 months after the shooting, we spent about a week with Ron and Lucy in Jacksonville, where Ron lived, and Atlanta, where Lucy lived. And we really just hung out, and we got to know who Jordan was, obviously, in his absence, through his parents. And we, you know, were fortunate enough to meet his girlfriend at the time and the three boys who were in the car with him at the time. And through that, we came to understand, you know, as best we could, who Jordan was. And that, by a tragic coincidence, happened to be a couple of weeks before the George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin verdict. And we, you know, deeply committed to making the film around that time. That was in, I think, June 2013. And then very slowly we managed to get access to the courtroom for the trial, which was the following February, and put me and a camera at the back of the courtroom.
That was amazing to me also, because, again, we've been doing so many shows, but so few of us know what goes on in the courtroom. This is an experience that none of us have. This is something we never see. And it was I almost feel like I'm now coming at all of this from a very different perspective, just seeing what goes on in the courtroom. How were you able to get such amazing access?
Well, ultimately, it was the judge's decision.
Really?
And they already had two CCTV cameras in there, which they normally would have just fed out to mainstream media every day. And basically we slipped in our camera as the third camera, and that camera also went out to mainstream media. But if you like, so they were getting better shots than they would have via CCTV, and we were able to retain all three cameras' worth of footage for the edit, which subsequently took about a year. But I think you're right. I think the two kind of driving narratives that intercut throughout the film. One is this, you know, words don't really describe it, but the almost the life of a death, you know, with Lucy and Ron, how they live through this 18 months following between Jordan's murder and the final verdict. That's one strand of the story, so to speak. And by being so close and intimate with them in a photographic way, I think we're able to go much deeper and way beyond what we understand about these stories from a kind of day-to-day news perspective.
Right.
And actually get to reflect on what this really means and what impact this has on families. And that's a very universal feeling. You know, no parent would ever want to bury their child, let alone, as Ron says in the film, be welcomed into this club that, you know, no parent wants to be a part of. And I think through the trial, I absolutely understand what you mean. Like, it's a very revealing space when it comes to how institutions work. And there are a couple of things that, like, for me, that really stood out having sat through the whole of the trial, one of which was this idea that race wasn't allowed to be mentioned in the courtroom. And the reason for that was that in pre-trial hearings, the defense lawyer had managed to get this idea that Michael Dunn, because he was not accused of a hate crime, therefore it would mar the jury's opinion if race was ever discussed inside the courtroom. So you had this very strange juxtaposition between the kind of how the institution dealt with that 3.5 minutes and then what the public reaction was to that 3.5 minutes, which was, of course, all about race.
Right, because it was also amazing to watch Michael Dunn be questioned after it happened. You got the video of that. And then to hear the phone calls between Michael Dunn and his fiance, you also got access to that. And so you learn that he called it thug music, that he talked about boys with their pants down, where are their fathers, animals. I mean, these stereotypes that, frankly, we hear on a regular basis now when these things happen. So you do learn more about his character. And it was interesting to see that they tried to keep that out of the courtroom.
I think Michael Dunn, in film terms, it was an incredible character, and the reason being that he was so naive to his own racism that, in a way, for me, having spent so long editing the film, he became almost this metaphor for other parts of America that are naive to their racism.
And what about that, Ron? I mean, it's, you talk in the film with Jordan's friends about conditioning. And, you know, it's amazing to also watch Jordan's friends, Leland Brunson, Tevin Thompson, and Tommy Storns. And they just talk about, you know, thug is the new N-word. This is what we have to deal with on a regular basis. And so talk a little bit about that conditioning, that a lot of people don't even know that they've been conditioned to begin with.
Yeah, you know, I travel a lot. I used to work at Delta Airlines in sales, and I was afforded to travel probably to about 35 countries. So I know other countries where they look at people that are African American, and I hear what they say, and I engage them to talk. And most of the time, a lot of the things that they tell you that they know about African American is based on movies and based on TV series, because every time that there is a drug dealer, there's somebody black in the movie, or there's somebody black in the TV series. Whenever we need a prostitute, there's somebody black or Latino or Latina in there. Every time, you know, you see a bunch of homeless people in a ghetto neighborhood or something like that, then, you know, they call around for black people, and then you see black people held up. You know, and they have us viewed around the world in such low esteem that people that don't engage African Americans, that don't really know who we are, they form their opinion based on what they see on that television. And that's what I was saying in the film. You know, you have the bias based on that. It's just as if I've never met a Japanese person and never engaged in a Japanese person, and I sit around and I start looking at things like Pearl Harbor and all these other things, I may form an opinion about Japanese people, you see? And so that's what happens to people. And Michael Dunn, he has only seen what he's seen on television about black people. So now he knows he can't call him the N-word, you know, so now it's stuck. He's made up in his mind. As a matter of fact, his neighbor, who he had for about 8 years, his neighbor told us, and he was not called as a witness in the trial, but he said Michael Dunn said nigger so many times when they were neighbors that he told Michael Dunn if he said nigger one more time that he was not going to be allowed in his house. Mm. And Michael Dunn said, well, what's the problem with that? He said, well, if you don't understand what the problem is of that, then you don't need to be my neighbor. We don't need to, you know, have a neighborly conversation. And, you know, so that's where Michael Dunn is coming from. So that's when he changed and decided to use thug as the N-word, because he even known from his neighbor that that was improper. Now, his neighbor told my lawyer this. So, but see, they thought it was too inflammatory. We're not going to bring it in the courtroom, because then when he tries to appeal, they may overturn the decision based on appeal. So we couldn't use that. We couldn't use some letters that were written by Michael Dunn while he was in jail when they wouldn't give him bond. You know, he said things like 90% of the black people here are a bunch of idiots and the white people here should take guns and kill all of them.
Wow.
We couldn't use that in this trial. You know, and more and more I understood that it was a trial of Michael Dunn. It wasn't a trial of Jordan Davis. Jordan Davis was just a sidebar to what was going on in trial. We couldn't even call Jordan Davis a victim. The judge said we couldn't even call him a victim because the defense attorney objected. He said because it makes Michael Dunn, his client, look guilty if there's a victim. So after three shots to the chest that my son endured, we still in court records could not call Jordan Davis a victim. Neither could we show an ID picture other than the picture ID that you use for a driver's license. That is the only picture in court we could show of Jordan Davis. They said no family pictures, no pictures of him interacting with his friends, no pictures of him interacting at school friends, only just that picture, because we don't want anybody in the jury to connect with the victim. We want them to connect with Michael Dunn so we can show Michael Dunn with his family. We can show Michael Dunn at the wedding of his son. We can show Michael Dunn interacting with his ex-wife. But nothing about Jordan can we show interacting with family members. The judge even said to me and Lucy at the beginning of the first trial, we don't want you to sit in the first row. Customarily, the victim's family sits in the first row, but we don't want you to sit in the first row because the jury may feel sorry for you, and Michael Dunn is going to decide that he did not get a fair trial if the jury feels sorry for the family. So what we want you to do is sit in the second row, and we'll have some people sit in the first row in front of you.
Wow.
Those are some of the things that you don't know that came out, you know, in the trial that you don't see on film. All the way up until, if you notice how stoic I look most of the time, I would just maybe wipe my eyes. The judge admonished me and his mother and said to us, if you show too much emotion in court, we're going to have to ask you to leave. If you shout or say anything in court, it may be a chance for us to take this and overturn this or send it to a different county. You can't make any sound to tell your friends and your family members we don't want any noise or crying in the courtroom while the jury is in session. So we had to sit there and take the lies that Michael Dunn was telling about our son. And whenever you saw me in the film staring straight, it looks like I was looking at the judge. I was looking behind the judge. There was a seal of Florida, the great state of Florida. And on that seal, I kept reading, "In God we trust, in God we trust, in God we trust." I kept reading that, and that's the only thing that held me still.
Today we are talking about the new documentary, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. It looks back at the November 23rd, 2012 shooting of 17-year-old Jordan Davis in Jacksonville, Florida. Directed by Mark Davis, we're also joined by Jordan's father, Ron. The film follows Ron and Jordan's mom, Lucy, as they deal with the aftermath of their son's murder. You know, it's just so amazing, Ron, because the average person has no idea that this is what's going on in the trial. I mean, if these shootings even make it to trial, that's a big deal.
Right.
But the fact that what you're telling me, I mean, like I said, I've done so many shows on these issues, and this just does not come up.
Yeah. They don't allow it. They don't allow it in court. In court, is the family is really, your I guess your esteem is taken away from you in court. your admiration for the judicial system is taken away from you in court. They're allowed to tell lies when your child is victimized. A victim, thank God Jordan didn't have any alcohol, he didn't drink, he didn't have any marijuana, he didn't smoke. The cigarette that they stopped for was for the driver, which was Tommy. He was the only one. He was an older kid. He was 19. He's the only one that was smoking it, you know, so the kids wasn't buying cigarettes also. And Jordan never handled a gun in his life. I never handled a gun in my life. So, you know, those kind of things and references that they were doing in court, gangster rappers and all that, Jordan didn't even have tattoos on his body. Mm. So I don't know many gangster rappers without tattoos.
Well,
so,
and
you know, these things.
It's so sad because even if he did, right, if he smoked, if he had marijuana in his pocket, if he was covered in tattoos.
Right. But you don't deserve to be murdered.
Right. But again, it's major character assassination. Mark, we have a couple minutes before break, but you're from the UK, so you come at this from a slightly different perspective. What was your reaction when you kind of learned about the ins and outs, not including race in the trial, not allowing Jordan's parents to sit in the front row?
Yeah, I mean, coming from the UK, I think I had the luxury, if you like, of being able to see this maybe from more of a kind of bird's eye view and see these systemic kind of links between all these issues. You know, on the one hand, I think that helped me direct the film, having that distance. And on the other hand, I think there are themes within the film which are so universal when it comes to race, inequality and power structures, that actually, you know, wherever this story unfolded, I would have approached it with the same kind of attitude. But when it comes to all those things that Ron just listed about how almost abusive it felt to, as a parent, to be in the courtroom, the sad thing is that those short-term painful things that they had to go through in how they were able to be sort of were allowed to be treated within the court environment in a sad way. I respect that the judge was so strict about those things, because really the long-term aim of the judge was that he didn't want there to be any grounds for appeal in the future. And I thought one of the most powerful things for me, which if I was Lucia Owen, I would have found, you know, the most offensive thing I had to sit through in the trial, was every day the judge turning around to Michael Dunn and asking if he felt that the day had gone well, whether he'd been fairly represented, whether there was anything he needed to raise. And as painful as that was to sort of live through in the present, it really was, with respect to the judge, that he didn't want there to be an appeal later on.
And that is Mark Silver. He is director of the new film, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. It opens July 24th at the Presidio Theater in San Francisco and the Rialto in Berkeley. I am also joined by Ron Davis, Jordan Davis's father. Jordan was killed on November 23rd, 2012. He was 17 years old. He and three friends pulled into a gas station in Florida to buy gum and cigarettes. Michael Dunn and his fiancée pulled in next to them in a parking lot. Dunn demanded they turn down the rap music they were playing. He became very angry after they refused. They exchanged a few words. Michael Dunn pulled his gun out of his glove box, shot at their car 10 times, shot Jordan Davis 3 times in the chest. And this new documentary, 3.5 Minutes, tells this story. I really hope you can see it. It's an incredible documentary. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. Please tune in live tomorrow at 10 a.m. Thank you. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are talking about the new documentary, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. It looks back at the November 23rd, 2012 shooting of 17-year-old Jordan Davis in Jacksonville, Florida. The film opens on July 24th at the Presidio Theater in San Francisco and the Rialto in Berkeley. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. And just to summarize what happened again. On November 23rd, 2012, four black teens pulled into a gas station in Jacksonville, Florida to buy gum and cigarettes. A white man, Michael Dunn, and his fiancée pulled in right next to them in the parking lot. Michael Dunn demanded they turn down the rap music they were playing, and he became very angry after they refused. After they exchanged a few words, he pulled his gun out of his glove box, shot at their car 10 times, and shot as they were actually trying to get away. One of the boys, 17-year-old Jordan Davis, was killed. He was shot in the chest 3 times. After the shooting, Michael Dunn and his fiancée, who was in the store when the shooting happened, went to a hotel and ate pizza, and they never called the police. The new documentary, 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets, tells the story, directed by Mark Davis. He's creative director of the Filmmaker Fund. He works around the globe as a filmmaker, director of photography, and social impact strategist. We're also joined by Jordan's father, Ron. The film follows Ron and Jordan's mom, Lucy, as they deal with the aftermath of their son's murder and attend both of Michael Dunn's trials. We were talking about the trial before the break, Ron, and again, it's amazing to watch you watch Michael or watch you watch the fiance. What was it like for you to be in the courtroom every single day?
Well, we ended up through all the motions and, you know, just leading even up to the trial. I think we were in the courtroom at least 30 times in the courtroom, even leading up to the trial. And so in the trial, just to watch his fiance go up, she was shaking like a leaf. She was crying, and when he said, put up your right hand, she put up her left hand and then told her to put up her right hand. And when she sat down, she was just a mass of tears. And one of the things that I thought sitting there was that, you know, this woman, I think she looked at all the things that had happened since then and how her life has changed. And this man who she was going to marry, she still felt in the first trial some loyalty for him, not wanting to leave him while he was going to trial, not wanting to leave him while he's in jail, that pull of deserting him. And so she had that, and I think she was conflicted with what he had done. But by the time the second trial rolled around, I think all that had changed. She was not his fiance at that time anymore, and I think she had made a decision that this man did something so horrible. How could she ever think of being married to this guy? And in the second trial, she wouldn't even look at him. Wow. You know, the first trial, there was kisses and blowing kisses. And then the second trial, she wouldn't look at him. And she just walked right past him without looking his way. And I just felt that she was disgusted by the whole thing when reality really hit her, how awful this man did. Not only did he shoot Jordan, again, remember, he tried to shoot the other child that was at the front door. However, the door has metal in it in the front door. It has only plastic in it in the back door. So the bullets couldn't go through the door in the front door. There were 3 bullet holes. And so Kevin Thompson realized through this trial how close he came to death. Until those shots were shown in trial, Kevin Thompson didn't even know that he was that close to death. Mm-hmm. He had no idea. And when they found out and they saw the bullet holes, that they were dented in the inside where it had stopped the bullet, he told me personally that Mr. Davis, he said, I didn't know I almost died.
Wow.
And so Michael Dunn in trial that we didn't put in the film also, but what he said in the second trial was that he stopped shooting at the fleeing car because they were out of sight. And the question from the prosecutor was, if it still was in your range, would you have continued to shoot because you had about 5 more bullets left in your gun? He said, oh, yeah, if I had to shoot 50 times, I would have continued to shoot. The jury heard that and understood what he meant. He meant to kill all 4 of those children.
Michael Dunn got an additional 90 years for the attempted murders of Jordan's friends, Leland Brunson, Tevin Thompson, and Tommy Storrens. And, you know, it's incredible to watch them in the film talk about stereotypes about black kids, about what they have to deal with on a regular basis, about talking to you about Jordan, about missing Jordan. How has Black Lives Matter and this massive movement affected those three boys?
Well, they knew that I had went up to New York. I was asked to come up to New York to help lead the Black Lives Matter march in New York, which was December 13th, the day of protest. And I held that banner with a lot of pride, and I was up there with some of the coordinators of Black Lives Matter. And we had 50,000 people where we shut down Broadway. And when I came back, I told those kids, I said, understand this. I said, 50,000 people, and we walked for 6 hours down Broadway and chanting Black Lives Matter. Over 60% of the people that were chanting were white, and they had their white teenagers and kids with them. They were Irish, they were Jewish, they were Italian, they were everything. And so I said, that is a movement. When you have a movement, it's not a black movement, it's a movement of being right from wrong. It's a movement about, if we're going to truly be America the Beautiful, we have to start being beautiful in our hearts. And when something is wrong, no matter what race it is against, we have to speak out. If I'm black and something's going wrong and it's against the Irish, I don't look at it as an African-American and say, well, they're doing that to the Irish, so it's okay. I have to speak out against wrongful things, whether it's the Irish, the Jewish people, Palestinians, no matter who it is. Right is right and wrong is wrong. And I told those kids, and they understood, that don't go and take from this that somebody was racist against you. And I don't want you as children to understand that and walk out and be racist against or biased against any other person that's non-black. So I want you to go out and make sure you treat everybody equally and look at the character of your friends and not look at the color of their skin. And they understood that.
And you know what's interesting about the film is what you just described, Ron, is being talked about, but I feel like there's piecemeal. So this story addresses that. That story addresses another issue. You've got, you know, ProPublica and the Washington Post looking at the statistics. What I think the film does so well is it brings it all together. And there was a YouTube comment that I wanted to read because, you know, I'm hoping that if this film gets the attention it deserves, I mean, I think it can really change things, because this comment said, this was actually one of the first times that I, as a white American, started to realize that maybe, just maybe, racial profiling of young black men and other people of color in this country is a serious problem that needs to be addressed. It makes me realize something needs to be done. I really want to see this movie to see what it adds to the discussion. This was just based on the trailer.
Yeah, that's absolutely great. You know, comments like that spur you on. You know that you're doing the right thing and that you're in the right direction. And one thing that when I do Q&A for these films, I like to stress is this, and I hope I can stress it on your show, is that when people see the protesters in the street and they see Black Lives Matter, they're not saying that white lives don't matter, because that's a given. Everybody around the world knows that white lives matter. What they're saying is Black Lives Matter because in this country, it seems day after day, week after week, month after month, we see black men and women, black children, being shot down in the street, not only by law enforcement, but by average citizens, as if their lives don't matter. And so we have to make sure that everybody is aware that, hey, black lives matter. And so that's why we say that, and I don't want anybody to take an offense to that. We're saying that because they need to be heard. These families need to understand that their lives matter, that these kids that they have, that they send to school to be doctors and lawyers like every other race, they do matter. So that's why we do that.
Mark, what's your reaction to that comment? It weaves all these different elements together in such a human way.
Yeah, I think that ultimately is the difference between the kind of documentaries I would like to make and have made compared to sort of day-to-day news. And I think day-to-day news almost leaves you feeling lost and disconnected from the human side of all of this. And the kind of politics with a capital P is a turn-off for most people. And the fact that through that experience of day-to-day news and politics, you're almost disempowered to think that you can do anything about any of these issues. Mm-hmm. And I think what's important in the film and what comes through, Lucy and Ron essentially still kind of parenting Jordan, even though obviously he's not with us anymore. I think there's something that you learn that's greater and more meaningful than politics with a capital P, which is you're invited to reflect yourself on how you have relationships with other people and how you are conditioned to perceive other people. And ultimately, for me, I think one of the most powerful things in the film, and comes across via, as you said, just the trailer, is for, I think, white audiences in particular to reflect upon whether they're even aware of their own biases and kind of delve into that and be open about talking about that, because it's only by being open and acknowledging it that we can get anywhere near beginning to change these things.
Mark Silver is director of the new documentary 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets, which looks back at the November 23rd, 2012 killing of 17-year-old Jordan Davis. He was with three friends. They pulled into a gas station in Florida to buy gum and cigarettes, Jacksonville, Florida. A white man, Michael Dunn, and his fiance pulled in right next to them in the parking lot. They had loud rap music playing. Dunn demanded they turn it down. They did, then they turned it back up. He became angry after they refused. After exchanging a few words, Michael Dunn pulled his gun out of his glove box, shot at their car 10 times. Jordan Davis was shot 3 times in the chest. Michael Dunn and his fiance, who was in the store when the shooting happened, left the parking lot, went to a hotel, ate pizza, never called the police. And the new documentary tells this story in such an amazing way. And it opens July 24th at the Presidio Theater in San Francisco and the Rialto Cinema in Berkeley. We're also joined by Jordan's father, Ron Davis. The film also follows Ron and Jordan's mom, Lucy, as they deal with the aftermath of their son's murder and attend both of Michael Dunn's trials. I want to go back to the humanizing piece of this, Mark. Talk about how important that was for you, because thanks to video, we're seeing so many things that are happening now. But it's happening so regularly, and I'm hoping we don't become used to it, because we become so numb to violence and things in this country, in the world. But you're now hearing so many things almost weekly happen. What I'm afraid of is that the humanity will get lost because things are moving so fast. So can you talk about the importance of really showing the humanity of Jordan and what happened?
Yeah, I think something that's been really shocking is since we premiered the film in January, so 6 months ago roughly, it's tragic that wherever the film has gone and whatever festival it's been in up until now, there is always a new name and a new event that brings resonance to the story wherever people are watching the film. I think for us, it was always very important, and in a way, we used elements of the media and how they were talking about the case in Jacksonville and nationwide to almost show the kind of dehumanizing power that mainstream news media can have on these situations, and also the power they have in the conditioning of people's opinions. Yeah, we felt it was hugely important to be able to not just think about these issues, but feel these issues. And one of the hardest things to tackle was, how do we introduce Jordan, who of course I never met and the audience never get a chance to meet? How do we humanize someone who is absent? And I think by getting very deep with his parents, Lucy and Ron, his girlfriend, his friends, you learn who Jordan was in his absence through these other people. And I think ultimately that was quite a beautiful way of humanizing Jordan.
And that's the other thing, Ron, is sometimes we learn about these kids, but you don't really learn that much. And we've had other parents on who have said, we'd like to have more time to talk about our child, but we're so busy with the legal information and trying to figure out that road that we sort of don't have time to do that. So, you know, we see photos of Jordan when he was a baby. You both talk about how badly you wanted a child. Why don't you talk a little bit about Jordan and your relationship with him?
Well, Jordan, we call him our miracle child, because we were told by doctors that Lucy could never have a child, because every time she would get pregnant, the baby would attach to the same side of her uterus, to uterine wall. And it was a very weak side. And no matter what they do, the baby would always, you know, so she had, I think, 2 miscarriages and also a fetal demise. And so we said, okay, well, we'll stop at that, because Lucy was just struggling with it mentally and everything and physically. And so, and then she ran across this other specialist and this doctor, and she said that I have a procedure that I like to try. And what she would do is kind of turn the uterus to the other side for a little while. While the baby tried to attach to the wall, it would actually attach to the opposite wall because of the turning of the uterus. And she did that procedure, and it worked. and we would monitor every month, and you know, month after month, and we were just hoping for the best. And then when she got into her like a seventh month, we were like, I think this is happening, you know. And so she was scheduled for a C-section, you know, after she got, you know, within the ninth month. And I made it my business that I was going to be the first one that Jordan saw when he came out in this world. And I was staring right at him when he came out, all the blood. I just said it in my mind that this blood is fake blood, is ketchup or whatever. You know, I just kind of changed my mind about blood so I could just get through it. And I would just look at Jordan. As soon as he came out and opened his eyes, I was the first one he looked at. And when they cleaned him off, I was the first one who kissed him. You know, I always told him that. He always would smile and get embarrassed about that. You know, and then growing up, he liked to run behind me, you know, his dad. And I remember the first time in Georgia where he saw snow, and he kind of thought it was ice cream. And it didn't make the cut on the film, but I did give Mark a little video of that. But he ran outside, and I was outside with him. He had a little snowsuit on, and he picked up the snow and put it in his mouth like it was ice cream, and he was smiling and laughing. And then he didn't realize how cold snow could get. And that snow got real cold on his lips and on his hand, and he started crying, and I started warming him up. And it was so cute of him realizing that this snow is good for a minute, but after it gets cold, it really is not that good. And, you know, he would cry, and, you know, we would have different places that we'd go to, you know, when he got older. He would play baseball. He played in a little pony league. He was an all-star player. He liked to pitch, you know, and this is when he was about 8 years old. And but when they asked him to play the outfield, he didn't like it because it wasn't exciting enough. He liked the excitement. He liked to roller skate, and he liked to play PlayStation with me. He would never buy a PlayStation unless it was for two. It had to have two players on. That was the first thing he looked at, because he made Dad play with him. He wanted me to play with him, and he liked to beat me until I got good enough to beat him. And then we would go on to another game. And one of our favorite games was Risk, R-I-S-K. That was one of our favorite games, and also Monopoly. Those were our favorite games to play. And right now, when I look at those games, I've kept those games, and I just think of Jordan so much because we played him so much. And we went fishing a couple of times, but he liked crabbing, where we get the crab nets and catch blue crabs, and he liked that. And one of our biggest things that we did together that I always remember, and I cry every time I think about it, is that Jacksonville Beach next to the pier. And you'll see the pier in the film, in Mark's film. And right at that area by the pier, me and Jordan used to go and get in the beach. He was a great swimmer, and I'm a good swimmer. I'm a scuba diver also. And we used to play jump the waves, and we would try to stand up under the onslaught of the waves, and whoever fell down would lose a point, and we would go up to 10 points. And, man, we would just try to stay with those waves, and we would jump. And we would just laugh. And those were the biggest laughs, and I can see the beach now, and I try to get out there whenever I can, because I just hear Jordan's laughter from jumping the waves at the beach.
Ron Davis is Jordan Davis's father. He was 17 years old when he was killed on November 23rd, 2012 by Michael Dunn in a gas station parking lot in Jacksonville, Florida. Jordan and his three friends pulled in to buy gum and cigarettes. Michael Dunn parked next to them, demanded they turn down their rap music. He became angry when they refused. They exchanged a few words. Michael Dunn pulled his gun out of his glove box, shot at their car 10 times, and shot Jordan Davis in the chest 3 times. The new documentary, 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets, looks back at the 2012 killing with a focus really on the devastating effects of racism and also looking at the search for justice in the courtroom. It opens July 24th, Presidio Theater in San Francisco, and the Rialto in Berkeley. And I'm also joined today by Mark Silver, who is 3.5 minutes, 10 bullets director. He's a filmmaker, director of photography, and creative director of the Filmmaker Fund. And Mark, this experience is also pretty wild for you, because you're going to be doing a ton of interviews. You're going to be asked about race in the United States as someone from the UK. So what has it been like for you?
I mean, I not just obviously coming from the UK, but being white as well. And
right.
I think my kind of filmic relationship with Michael Dunn, I was able to see things in Michael Dunn that I think are hugely important for white audiences to be able to reflect upon. Mm. As I mentioned earlier, this idea that he was so naive to his own racism, I think, was a very powerful message in the film. And I think by the end of the film, you'd almost be inhuman not to take that opportunity to reflect on some of the things that Michael Dunn said in relation to feeling fear when he pulled up next to that car full of black teenagers. And tragically, you know, I don't think he's the only person who feels that fear, and therefore I think the film invites you as an audience to question, you know, would you have felt that fear? Do you feel that fear? And hence, why do you feel that fear? I think when we think about you know, the kind of level of humanization, as you said, that happened in this film, I think there is something kind of valuable about forensically examining those 3.5 minutes. And even though, of course, it's the story of what happened to Jordan Davis, in many ways that 3.5 minutes came to represent what's happened in many of these cases. That could have been the 1.5 seconds that it took to shoot Tamir Rice, or the 4 hours that Michael Brown lay on the ground. And I think that that's really the humanizing power that this film has.
And Ron, you got a text message a couple of days after this happened from Trayvon Martin's father. And he said, I just want to welcome you to a club that none of us want to be in.
After he texted me, what he did was he texted me and told me how sorry he felt about it. That was in the text message. So actually, when I got the text about how sorry he was about that and whatever, and then I called him, and we actually spoke on the phone, and that's when he said that I just want to welcome you to a club that none of us want to be in. And so he actually verbally said that to me when I called him from the text message, explaining his sorrow that my son had died. So I actually got to speak with him. And we've been really just in contact since our kids were killed. You know,
right.
People, you know, across this country and even throughout the world, they connect these boys who look so much alike, and they were both 17-year-old kids, good kids. They connect them a lot. And I tell people all the time, I said, I am just gratified that, you know, to be in the same company with that young man. That young man was great. Trayvon didn't deserve to die. You know, he was minding his own business. And if you're going to put my son with somebody, I'm honored that you would put him with that young man, because I really feel that that young man and Jordan, they were good kids, and they would have been friends had they met, you know, and maybe they have met already now. And understand that that's what this talk is all about, our kids and the things that we do, you know, to show that our kids may have died physically, but spiritually our kids will never die.
When you get together with the parents, Ron, what do you all talk about when you think about where this is going next or the changes that we need to see? Because there's so much conversation about police reform, for example. There's also conversations about the talk you have to have with your child of color. There's also the conversations about unconscious bias. I mean, lots of conversations happening. But where do you think the change is really going to come from, and what would you like to see?
The first thing that I want is to have Stand Your Ground amended, because I think the duty to retreat part of it is just putting two people who are angry that may have weapons, you put them in a ring and tell them to go ahead and fight, that you're being covered by the United States Constitution. You know, that you know, your state laws are saying that it's okay if both of you stand your ground, and if both of you have a shootout, and if you have stray bullets and hit other people, there's just collateral damage. So you can have mayhem, just like Michael Dunn shot in the gas station, could have killed anybody else in the gas station, had one of the tanks blown. So what I look at is in the film that struck me, and it took a while for me to see this in the film. I think it took maybe the third or fourth showing. Is that the man that said that he heard Michael Dunn say, "You're not going to talk to me that way," he actually pulled into the drive right next to the kids and decided he didn't want to hear the loud music. So he pulled into another parking space, went in the store, and said, "Oh, now they're playing this music. I wish they'd turn it up because that's my favorite song." That is so important to me, and I want the audience to understand that, because that man stood his ground by doing what he did, which was park in another parking space. Michael Dunn stood his ground and did it the incorrect way. These are two ways to stand your ground. The man that stood his ground goes home to his family and can be there for his family. Michael Dunn, that claims he stood his ground, is in life prison with no chance of parole, also as a murderer of a teenage kid. So when you look at those two things, that should tell you something as a human being. There's always decisions to make. Do you want to be the Michael Dunns of this world or the other witness and go home to your family?
Right.
And that's what struck me so strong in this film.
Yeah, I was struck by that too. Again, the other guy could have parked there and decided not to, just made a decision. Right. Yeah, that's pretty intense. What are your final thoughts, Mark, as the film has opened and it's about to just continue opening across the country?
Again, I think, like me, you know, not being American, I think for me, maybe one of the greatest kind of takeaways or whatever might be that this idea or almost brand identity that the US is a post-racial society, I think that's probably what I'm most looking forward to the film being able to provoke discussion about.
Mark Silver is director of 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. It opens on July 24th at the Presidio Theater in San Francisco and the Rialto Cinemas in Berkeley. Ron Davis is Jordan's father. 17-year-old Jordan Davis was killed on November 23rd, 2012, in a gas station parking lot in Jacksonville, Florida, by Michael Dunn. Again, the film is 3.5 Minutes, 10 Bullets. You can find more information and I hope you can see this film and really spread the word. Yourcallradio.org. Mark and Ron, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
What can you do for fun this summer that's free or low cost? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about free events and activities, hikes and nature walks, and new ways to explore the Bay Area's neighborhoods and cultural treasures. We'll be joined by guests from Fun Cheap SF, the Bay Nature Institute, and the San Francisco Chronicle, and we want to hear from you. Where do you go to find free summer fun? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Yeah.